G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and also keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
G'day, you too.
Thank you for coming back on, my friend. I know you're doing a bit of babysitting today.
I'm doing a little babysitting today. Kids are going back to school. His Highness Halevi III is not very interested in being a kindergarten, so they took him in for a couple of hours and then sent him back home.
Yeah, so they're hanging out with Dad. So you got Halevi number 3 and 4, Halevi the 3rd and Halevi the 4th, and they're joining us on the program today, which I'm very excited about because they're so very cute.
Yeah, so you might hear every once in a while one of them walking up to me and asking for something.
That's
funny. And you might hear some background noise from them playing with toys, but in general, I mean, there's nothing I can do. If we want to get the program on the air and do this, we have to endure with the noise of the children.
No, it adds an element of cuteness, and I'm happy to have it, and who knows, maybe they have something to add to the program, because today we are in Judges 18, and this is how it starts. Now, Yoel, just to bring everyone up to speed, of course, last week we did 17, and we were talking about the Levite who maybe wasn't a Levite. I mean, he was a Levite from Judah, but there's a question from Rick. Boy, Rick writes some good comments. G'day, Rick. He's got a question. Let me run it by you. He said, could the Hebrew allow for the man mentioned in verse 7 of chapter 17, this is the Levite, could it allow for him to be a Levite who resided in Bethlehem in Judea, and the term of the family of Judah refers to Bethlehem and not the man?
So let me give you a bit of insight about these last couple of chapters. Mm-hmm. Grammatically, there's a lot of obscurity here. There's a lot of confusion in the language. Literally, the last couple of chapters of the Book of Judges are probably very, very old.
Mm-hmm.
And probably predate most of the stories we have here. And they're added to the book at the end, and not really as part of the sequence. And one of the things that's always pointed out is that there's a lot of obscurity with the language itself. And this is where we said last week, it's not very clear. Because let's look at this. It says, Vayhi na'ar mi Bethlehem, and then there was a young man, a na'ar. So the word na'ar can be used as a young man or can be as a servant. There's a place, for example, where it uses the word, where it talks about Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about... Can you hear that?
Yeah, there's a little Halevi.
So, there's a place, for example, it says, V'yoshua na'ar lo emish min ha'ohil. So, the word na'ar there is actually used as servant. On the other hand, we have the word na'ar used for young boy. For example, V'tir'eu et ha'na'ar, which is mentioned about Moses, mm-hmm. and she saw the young boy, and that's where the word na'ar is used as a... the word na'ar is just used for boy. Now, when we go into other places, for example, in Deuteronomy, for this week, for example, we have the word na'ar and na'ara, specifically the word na'ara,
mm-hmm.
and it's used there for young lady, usually for a very young girl.
Mm-hmm.
And so the different uses it is. So here he's a na'ar. So it can be a whole bunch of things. It can be a young man, you know, that is only now starting to grow, and he's a servant. He was a servant. This is why he's referred as a Levite. So again, there's a lot of obscurity here, because then it says Vahina ar mi Bethlehem Yehuda. So it says, and there's a young man from, I'm going to say young man for now, a young man from Bethlehem of Judah, because there's a few other, there's always a lot of cases where there's these double names, where there's a place called this and a place where, for example, Carmel. So there's a place called Carmel, which is a village actually south of where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Mount Carmel, but that's north of here, way, way north near Haifa, where literally the mountain, the town of Haifa is on, the city of Haifa is on. And then it says, Mimishpachat Yehuda, from the family of Judah. And then it says, Vehu Levi, and he's a Levite. And this is where, Vehu Garsham, and he lives there. So if we remove Mimishpachat Yehuda, then we can clearly say, oh, he is...
a Levite living in Bethlehem.
He's a Levite living amongst the Judeans. Mm-hmm. Now, let me say why I like Rick's question here. Because you can say that in Bethlehem, the family of Judah were living, but he actually was a Levite.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But are we saying that Mimishpachat Yehuda, and this is the problem, that this adjectival clause here, Mm-hmm. Is it referencing to the subject Na'ar, or is it referencing to the, I would say, the locative clause we have here, Betlechem Yehuda? Now, the reason to reject that the Mishpachat Yehuda means living amongst the Judeans, or that place is under Judeans, is because it says Betlechem Yehuda. It's Betlechem of Judah. So yeah, because, the positioning here is a bit confusing.
So you would consider it unusual. So there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah. So it's Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, mentioning Judah twice. If it was in reference to Bethlehem, that would be odd. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that's exactly what I'm saying. Okay. It would be odd because we already mentioned it's Bethlehem of Judah.
Yeah. Okay.
Now we also don't know. We also don't know of any period of time that Bethlehem. Well, we do know.
We do.
And this raises the question, because we have in the story of King David, where he asks at the end there of the stories of King David, he asks there who would help me drink, or who would let me drink from the water hole of Bethlehem, and the three warriors breach through the Philistines. But that doesn't prove 100% anything, because you can say the Philistines took over Bethlehem afterwards. This is a very early story, and therefore Bethlehem actually was Judean. So I'm saying this little clause here, Mishpachat Yehuda, this just disrupts everything.
Uh-huh.
It's confusing. So I understand the question. You somewhat, maybe if you really squeeze it really hard, it can reference to Bethlehem, but it's probably referencing to Na'al. And this is one of the reasons why we say this section specifically is the entire section is very muffled and confused,
mm-hmm.
Which could be attributed to the fact that this was written a lot after the original story.
Sure.
And again, we have to remember, we did mention that this tribe of Dan don't really have anywhere to live, and we have probably these two stories are from a very early stage. And when someone actually sat down to write the Book of Judges, they were using stories which were known. And there were a few details which were not clear, and therefore someone, when they wrote it down, they put maybe both options in to try to maybe cover both, and it is muffled. I mean, you have to admit to that. You know, when I was reading this, I was reading different commentaries. One of the scientific commentaries I was using, which was actually written in Hebrew, and I have to say something very, very blunt here. The English commentaries, even if it's a scientific commentary, I found clear mistakes because their level of understanding of Hebrew is bad. And I actually want to use an example here for a moment. Oh, and actually, when I was asked about this a couple times the past couple of weeks, and I actually went through an English scientific commentary I have here, which is a very good one, and what I saw there was the issue of Samson. I was going over the story of Samson again because something did not make sense to me. You asked me a very simple question, which was, did Samson break Torah by the fact that he touched the dead body of the lion?
Sure.
And I was thinking, what is wrong here? Why would Jono ask me such a question if it's so clear? And again, I always have to bump myself in the head to realize that Jono's reading in English. You know, he's not been practicing his Hebrew much lately.
Don't tell everyone.
So I actually went to look at this commentary, and they mentioned this as well. And I was thinking, what is wrong here? And I suddenly realized that there's a problem with the translation of the verse about the Nazarite, where it says that nefesh met lo yavo, he will not come to the dead. Now the word I'm using the reason the word dead deliberately because it uses the word met. Now, but the word met in biblical Hebrew usually means a dead person, because if it's an animal, it uses either the word nevela or trefa. And when it wants to reference to a person as dying in a violent death or being disgraced as a body, it would use the word nevela, but it usually just uses the word met. And if you go, for example, the laws of uncleanliness when it comes to the dead, it uses the word met as well. So it's pretty clear the word met usually means a dead person. Also, it's in conjunction with the whole thing where it says it to his father and his mother and his brothers. He's like a high priest. He's not allowed to come in touch with with the dead. Now, we also have to remember something very, very important. A verse, when we take the equation of verse equals sentence, is incorrect. 2-3 verses can also equal sentence.
Ah, good point.
Okay?
Sure.
It's a very important thing we have to remember. The verses, we have to remember something. These things were read in public, and therefore we have to break these things down. We can't have words, sentences which are very, very long. We have to have shorter sentences. So it's actually very rhythmic sometimes. If you look how it's broken down in Hebrew, it's very rhythmic.
Mm-hmm.
So So taking all of this back, when you don't really know the Hebrew, you miss out on a lot of these little details, but you also sometimes miss out on the muffled sections, because your English translation can be based on, say, for example, the Septuagint, and the Septuagint was played with. Mm-hmm. People were played with. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there saying, oh, Septuagint is the best, blah, 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 blah. It isn't. And let me explain why. She wrote something about this on Facebook as well, but let me explain very quickly why. The Septuagint itself, what we have today is not the original. What we have today is part of, it was rewritten again and again and again. There was the original form, and then it developed more and more and more. We reached a point there were different versions of it because each person expressed their opinion into the text itself. And when they actually translated the prophets and the writings, they... just a second. My son is playing here with something. So he's playing around with my cell phone. So anyhow, one of the things that, going back to the issue of the Septuagint, one of the things that we basically have a problem with is that what we have today is actually what we can call, quote-unquote, the Gentile version of the Septuagint, which means whoever wrote it, there's a lot of stuff they didn't know. There's a lot of concepts they didn't understand. There's a lot of Hebrewisms they didn't understand. So it's a problem what you have in the Septuagint. There's a lot of places where the version of the Septuagint is actually slightly better sometimes. But essentially, if we look into things, we discover that the Septuagint was actually corrected. There are ways of discovering that. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to explain them now, but there are places where it's very clear and evident. The person who wrote the Septuagint we have today and the translations that we have today, are probably problematic. And this is why now there's a push to translate directly from the Hebrew.
Yeah, certainly. Well, look, let me give you an example of that, because the very next comment, Yoel, is from James. And James writes on last week's program, he wrote, I always thought that Melchizedek, being a king of Salem, was called a priest and a king. And I also hear a lot of talk about Melchizedek, the Melchizedek priesthood. Is there no priesthood older than that of Aaron and the Levites? And was there an older priesthood? Was it supplanted by the Levitical priesthood? And finally, is there a reference to Yeshua telling his followers that they would be priests and kings in his kingdom? How would this be understood? Thanks, Jim. Well, Jim, or James, Jim, we've actually spoken about that one a number of occasions, and I've spoken about it a few times on Truth to You. In fact, the last time I spoke about it in a little bit of detail on Ira's program, which is Treasures in the Tanakh, and it was in regards to Job chapter 5. So if you go to Job chapter 5, you'll find some detail in regards to the so-called Melchizedek priesthood. But once again, it's a problem in the Septuagint where a particular word is used a handful of times and translated two totally different ways, one of which is absolutely unrelated to the Hebrew word, Devarati. So there's some homework for you in regards to Melchizedek. I know we mentioned it briefly, was it last week or the week before, and it brings up some questions, but it really comes down to the word order, Devarati, in the Hebrew, Psalm 110, verse 4, and the way that it is translated in the Septuagint. So I'm glad you brought that up, Yoel.
We actually did a very long discussion about that specific one when we talked about the issue of tithing.
It was in the one on tithing. Brilliant.
We went in great detail on that one. I explained that Devarati doesn't mean older, and we explained that one in great detail on the one we did on tithing, which was over a year ago, I think. We explained that one. So again, there was another comment that I saw about a person. The person was quoting, it might have been either the BDB or the Strong's Concordance, but the word Kohen, and trying to explain it, you know, basically copying what it says. And by the way, that's not the method to actually fully understand a word in Bible, because you really have to also look at the context. Now, what I said was that Kohen, yes, it was a participle. It can be an active participle. Mm-hmm. It can also be an adjective. And this is, you know, goes into the world of derived words, if they're derived from nouns or verbs. But essentially, we have to remember that the concept of Kohen is to be in a position of something. So if someone is a Kohen, it doesn't necessarily mean he's a Kohen the way we perceive it afterwards, like we have with
Aaron. As a descendant of Aaron, that's right. So it's not necessarily a descendant of Aaron, because we find Kohens, ones that serve in a specific function, you know, in various, like we mentioned, I think we mentioned last week, the Kohens of Egypt, the Kohen that is Melchizedek, And Frank from Berlin brings up, of course, Exodus 19, verses 22 and 24, the Kohens that Yehovah refers to, saying, don't come, tell Moses, go down and tell them, don't come to the mountain. I'm going to get cranky. Go and tell them.
So again, this is the whole thing. So you have to remember not to confuse these things. Now, it's very, very important that you keep in mind that words are used in different ways, mm-hmm. For different reasons, and we can never ever say I know the meaning of the word because I opened up a dictionary and I saw that word, because you always have to look at the context it's in. Amen. Never ever try to understand a word just by opening up a dictionary, because a dictionary first can give you sometimes 5, 6, 7, 10, 15, 30 definitions. And you have to make a decision which one of the definitions actually fits the context it's in.
Mm, yeah. Okay. And so certainly in this case, Cohen is not in reference to a descendant of Aaron. That hadn't been established yet in Exodus 19. But obviously men of position.
Exactly.
Okay. And so, by the way, Yoel, Frank from Berlin, he also says, good day to the two of you. Thank you guys for your honesty and realness. Yah, blessings from Berlin. Thanks, Frank from Berlin. I like hearing from Frank in Berlin. And Darren Chan writes, Yoel, I appreciate your courage and determination to share your knowledge and understanding of the Hebrew Torah and the prophets with us. Through your teachings and experience, you are illustrating an inspiration of tremendous love towards all people desiring to intimately know the one who created us, the Holy One of Israel. And Anthony also writes, he says, I agree completely with Darren. Thank you, Jono and Yoel. You continue to truly be a blessing in my life. So thanks, guys, Darren and Anthony. Boy, we have great listeners, aren't we?
Yeah, we do. And Anthony actually happens to be one of my Hebrew students.
Hey, good on you, Anthony. And that is, of course, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com is the website if you would like to get Hebrew lessons, quality Hebrew lessons from the Levite in the desert. Now, we better get into this chapter.
I'm no longer the Levite in the land. I'm the Levite in the desert.
More specifically, in the desert. I think of you as this kind of little, you know, desert dweller. That's what you are now.
Well, yeah, I live in a house, but, you know.
No, in my mind, you're in a cave, you know, wrapped in a sheet.
No, I actually live in a house made out of concrete and...
with all your little Halevi army there.
Yeah.
Very, very cute that they are. Chapter 18, this is how it begins. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
In those days, Yoel, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. Well, we have to stop there. Do you want to explain that?
Well, first of all, when we spoke about Samson, I mentioned this as well, that the tribe of Dan were basically living amongst the Philistines and weren't really able to actually sit in their own land. And we also have, we look at Joshua, there's places where it mentions that they were not able to conquer them because they're too fierce. So they have iron chariots and stuff like that. So it's not surprising that this is mentioned. It's also setting the scene, you know, why do we suddenly bump into the Danites. What do they have to do with anything here? Yeah. So we really have to remember something interesting. Even chapter 17 is really kind of like half an introduction to chapter 18. So chapter 17 stands by itself telling one half of a story, but it's also an introduction to the next thing that's going to happen.
Indeed.
And that's the establishment, essentially the establishment of a probably another priesthood line in the northern tribes.
Ah, and you made that connection last week, which was fascinating. That's right. So maybe we can touch on that again. So it goes on to say, so the children of Dan sent five men of the family of their territory, five men of valor from Zorah and Eshtaol, to spy out the land. Quick, Keith. They're going to spy out the land. We're going to be doing a bit of that in March. Just a reminder to everybody. First couple of weeks of March 2013, we are going on a tour with Yoel and Keith and myself and a few others as well. You can get the details by going to truthtoyou.org, clicking on the Israeli flag, which is on the right-hand side, and it'll take you to the details. Better do it quickly because I know that the coach is filling up. But first couple of weeks in March 2013, in any case, they're going to spy out the land and search it. And they said, go and search the land. So they went to the mountains of Ephraim, where you used to live, Yoel, and they went to the house of Micah, and they lodged there. And while they were at the house, But Micah, they recognized. Is that what you've got? They recognized the voice of the young leader.
Hikiro, which means to recognize, which is very strange. What do you mean they recognize his voice? I mean, what is this? So it could be that he traveled a lot. He went everywhere.
Can I ask you this? Could it also mean that there was an accent to those from Bethlehem, maybe those from that area of Judah as opposed to where he is now? Could there be a difference in accent?
So that's also a big possibility. Though, if we say the story is actually from a very early stage, the accents were probably still very similar. It's a possibility. If the story is from a latter stage, then the accent. If it's not, then the accents were all the same.
Yeah.
They were just familiar. They knew who he was. He was famous. This guy's been everywhere.
Because you pointed out that perhaps, maybe he was what's known as a professional Levite, someone who was acting as a Levite, but not necessarily a Levite by birth. So maybe this guy's got a reputation. Who knows? But in any case, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. They turned aside and they started interrogating him. They said, "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here?" And they're firing questions at him one after another. And he said to them, "Well, first, the first thing that he says is, 'Thus and so.' Is that an expression? Is that a Hebrew expression? 'Thus and so'?
Kazov v'chaze, kach v'chach. Basically, instead of elaborating what really happened, he just, we're not elaborating because we already had what happened in chapter 17. So we're just skipping in, blah blah blahing it through."
That's what I thought. It's like, so this and that happened. So anyway, so this is interesting. I found it interesting when I read that because in the Torah, for example, the repetition of some things in the Torah is really intense, right?
here in the book of Judges, repetition is not really a strong side of it. Really, we don't have a lot of repetition in this place, which kind of indicates it's slightly later. The
scribes are getting lazier.
The scribes are using a completely different method.
Sure.
When they were writing the Torah, it was one method, and now we're writing another method, and here we're just skipping through. We're not going to repeat the same thing.
Fair enough. And so he said to them, "Thus and so Micah did for me. He has hired me, and I have become his priest." So they said to him, "Please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey on which we will go will be prosperous." And the priest said to them, "Go in peace. The presence of the Lord will be with you on your way."
There's a few things we have to pay attention to. First of all, they say to him, "Shal na ve'Elohim." They don't use the name. They say ve'Elohim. Ask God.
Mm.
And we'll know. And v'neda'an, we'll know. Hatitzlach darkeno, we'll succeed. And then suddenly he says, "Vayomer lahem ha'kohen." And the Kohen said to them, he's suddenly a Kohen. He's no longer the Levite.
True.
He's now the Kohen.
Yeah.
And he said, "Lechu leshalom, go in peace. Nochach Adonai." Now he's using the name. He's speaking with authority in the name of God.
Yeah.
He's lying. Hey, I'm a Kohen now, so I'm going to function as one, and I'm going to speak in the name of God.
And verse 6 does seem kind of flippant. It's like he's barely given it a thought. This is the way that I read it. It's as if he's barely given it a thought and just gone, it'll all be good. Go. The Lord says it'll be fine.
Now, the thing is that there's a thing called asking in the Urim and Thummim. The Urim and Thummim, as the English translation says. Sure. And this was a specific mechanism that had to be asked. Titiao Loritzok. It was a certain mechanism where you ask with the breastplate and everything. I mean, it doesn't really tell you exactly how things were done in the Torah. It just says, there's the asking the Urim and Tumim. We traditionally say that it's the breastplate. But I think that at this stage, they were slightly confused about exactly how do you ask God. And they probably had some kind of understanding here that God gives the inspiration, so then he gives an answer. And that's actually probably the incorrect way of understanding the asking God. And as you pointed out, that he doesn't give much thought. He just says, the Kohen said to them, go in peace, and the Lord will be with you, and you'll succeed. And, when you look at the process of how they used to ask God, they would throw a lot, and it was a whole process, and it looked like there's a whole ceremony going on there. So it raises a lot of questions about his conduct as a Kohen.
Mm, it certainly does. It certainly doesn't. So verse 7, so the five men departed. I mean, they were happy with that, Yoel. They departed, and they went to Laish and saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure. There were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. They were far from the Sidonians, and they had no ties with anyone.
So what is the, according to the Sidonians, kimishpat sidonim, the word mishpat, for again, the word shafat can mean, you know, the judgment or something, but here the word mishpat probably means according to the custom of the Sidonim, and but it's not very clear what that means. What exactly it means is according to the law, according to the practice of the Sidonim, it's not clear. So some people say because they were not really engaging in war with anyone, so they didn't feel, you know, the Sidonim were not at war with anyone, so they felt, you know, free to live in a way where there's not much security and not being too worried about people around them and didn't feel threatened. That's one way of understanding it. And it can be that really shoket uvoteach ve'en machlim davar ba'aretz yorash etzer could be a description of what the way of tzidonim means. But it's not really 100% clear what this term means.
Hmm. Well, in any case, they seem to be easy picking, and the spies come back. So their brethren at Zorah and Esh Ta'ol, and their brethren said to them, so what is your report? And they said, well, arise and let us go against them, for we've seen the land, and indeed it's very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go and enter to possess the land. And when you go, so
this slightly reminds me a bit of the language of the spies in the Book of Numbers.
Yeah, it's true, actually, yeah. Yeah, it does. I didn't think about that before, but that there is certainly a parallel there. It goes on to say, when you go, will you come to a secure you will come to a secure people and a large land, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth. I mean, that sounds pretty good. So 600 men, Yoel, 600 men of the family of the Danites went up from there, from Zorah and Eshtaor, armed with weapons of war, and they went up and encamped. Where did they encamp?
So first of all, 600 men, this is a very, very small number. And when you think about the numbers which we have in the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands, this, an army of 600 men, it's very, very small, which makes us wonder regarding a lot of the issues of numbering of people and how many people actually were there and stuff like that. I mean, how many people really existed at the time? Are we dealing with actual real numbers or not? Is 600 really 600, or is it some other number?
That's a valid question, because in Numbers, we're talking about 62,700 Danite soldiers. Exactly. And in the latter part of Numbers, we're talking about 64,400. It's certainly in the 60s. Here, there's just 600. So the question has to be asked. And the other question is, well, maybe they only thought they needed 600. You know, we don't have to send everyone.
But this is the actual group of people who are actually leaving Tzal'an Eshta'ol.
That's true.
And so first of all, says here, 600 ish chaguk lem milchama. These are 600 men carrying swords, which means 600 men, probably with 600 wives, is 1,200. Mm-hmm. Then probably children as well. So the number we really have here is probably greater. But again, we have so this also gives us kind of an idea what size towns these were, a couple hundred people. But on the other hand, if you look at this area, if you look in the land in general, there are villages left, right, and center. Mm-hmm. So the claims that, for example, the number of Israelites was a lot smaller is probably problematic. And also, there's also the whole discussion of square footage per person. How many people actually lived inside a square foot or a squared out area, and they probably were all living a bit more cramped than we are. So this raises a lot of questions regarding what exactly was the lifestyle at the time. But these are basically two towns, probably with hundreds of people in each town, which is probably relatively big at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they get up and they're moving. They're moving, just moving the whole thing out. But it doesn't necessarily mean this was the entire town as well. We have to think maybe this is part of the town, only part of the people are leaving Tzal'an Eshta'ol. Because if, for example, this is an earlier story, we see Tzal'an Eshta'ol again as being a Danite place, and there's still Danites living there. So this could be only just be a segment of the families, or half of the families, or whatever it would be, that decided that they want to live somewhere else.
Sure.
But we have some insight as well.
Yeah, that I just want to say that does make sense to me, that it's a part of them that's decided, let us go and find an area for us, for the family of Dan. Let's sort of branch out this particular group of the Danites. Let's branch out this way.
So exactly. So it gives kind of insight also on what was going on at the time. You know, I think groups were still moving around. People were still traveling. נגמרה סוללה, זהו.
אבא.
אין חשמל בפלאפון, זהו. נגמר החשמל.
אבא, כן.
He's so cute.
נגמר החשמל. So he's been using my cell phone to play with, and it's out of the battery. He ran the battery empty. So I tried explaining to him, there's no battery. אבל אין חשמל בטלפון, זהו, טלפון נגמר. אתה רוצה עוד? טוב, שנייה חמוד. Just a second.
Sure.
So where was I? So I'm connecting the cell phone to the electricity now. It's like, I want more of this. Why are you taking this away from me?
I was on a good thing, and now it's not doing it anymore.
Yeah. So going back to this issue, so we also see an interesting thing. At the time, there was also a lot of fluctuation of societies at the time as well. Groups were moving around everywhere. So it kind of shows that it probably fits the times as well, that people were, you know, these Philistines show up from the Greek islands.
Yes.
And we're having these groups from south moving to north and north moving to south looking for new places to live. And we find these Sidonim, which are basically a type of Canaanites, northern Canaanites, where Sidonim were also related to the issue of the Phoenicians. And we find these people and they're living far away from the regular place that most Phoenicians were living at. So it shows kind of what's going on here with the Danites is probably also to a certain degree normal at the time, where people were, okay, this area doesn't work for us, let's move somewhere else.
Yeah. I'm inclined to think that that's probably correct. And so then the five men who had gone to spy, well, hang on, before we get there, that's verse 14, but verse 13, and they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. So this place obviously sticks out, either that or it's on the main road, if you like.
We missed out on the word Kiryat Yarim.
Oh, yeah, do tell.
So Kiryat Yarim, the word Kiryat is another word for town or city.
Uh-huh.
And Yarim sounds like the word Yar. So this is some kind of a town that's in the woods or something like that. Or the town, which is woods. I'm not too sure about the actual name. Again, etymology of names of places and stuff like that is sometimes a bit problematic. But Yarim, you know, so Yar is usually Yarot in plural. So Yarim, not really too sure about the name.
Yeah, never mind. In any case, they pass through there, and the mountains of Ephraim, they come to the house of Micah. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their brethren, Hey, do you know what's in there? In those houses, there's an ephod, and there's household idols and carved images and molten image. Now, therefore, consider what you should do. So they turned aside there, and they came to the house of the young Levite man, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. And the 600 men armed with their weapons of war who were of the children of Dan stood by the entrance of the gate. And then the five men who had gone out to spy the land went up. Entering there, they took they just thought, well, I'll tell you what, I know what we'll do. Let's go in and we'll take the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, the molten image, and the priest, now it's Cohen, right? So the priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. And when these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the molten image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Be quiet."
What we're doing? I think it's a bit obvious what they're doing.
Yeah, it's pretty clear. Shut up. Put your hand over your mouth. You know. But then, do you remember?
He says to him, "Be quiet. Put your hand in your mouth, and come with us.
And come with us." Now, do you remember last week you were talking about the? You made mention of the mega church. And I said, we're going to be talking about that a bit later, because this guy, this so-called Levite, this so-called Cohen, he kind of likes the idea because the Danites put to him, listen, hey, put your hand over your mouth. Don't say anything. Come with us. We've got all this stuff. Be a father and a priest to us. Is it better for you to be a priest to the household of one man or that you be a priest to a tribe, a mega church of a family of Israel? And so... What does it say in verse 20?
And the heart of the he's now a Kohen, certainly, and the heart, Vitav Leva Kohen, his heart became happy. This is exactly what I wanted. I was traveling for so long, and look, it's happening.
It's finally happening. It's all happening, and now I
he takes the ephod. So now
he's inherited a megachurch.
Yeah, but now it says Vayikach et ha'efod. So now he's like, he's the one taking all the vestments and the instruments. They were taking, now he's helping them. He's picking them up and running off.
Yeah.
This is basically the description. He's picking them up. He's running off with them, basically saying, the heck with this guy who was just giving me a little bit of money. And, you know, I was nice to him and he treated me like his son and was family to me. The heck with that. Can you say heck? I don't know if you're allowed to say heck.
No, I don't know. Maybe in America, I don't know, but here. He's got the heck with that. And so we took the effort in the household gods and the carved image.
Just a second. So if we offended someone by saying that, I do apologize. I do know our people don't like words like that, so I do apologize if I offended someone.
You're an Israeli and I'm an Australian, so we wouldn't know. Well, so anyone's offended, apologies.
Who speaks English from a British background, so for us, heck means absolutely nothing. That's right. I'm just using it the way Americans would. So he's basically saying, I don't care about that person who took me in, treated me as family, who loved me like his son. I don't care about that person anymore. I'm running for the money.
Yeah, I've inherited a mega synagogue, perhaps. Well, maybe mega church is more appropriate.
A mega temple.
He's got a mega temple. So the priest's heart was glad he took the gear and he took his place among the people. And then they turned and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them, and when they were a good way from the house of Micah, the men who were in the house, the houses near Micah's house, gathered together and overtook the children of Dan, and they called out to the children of Dan, so they turned around and said to Micah, "What ails you that you have gathered such a company?" Okay, so hang on, if I'm to understand these couple of verses here, Micah's figured out what's happened. He's grabbed everyone that he can of his family, and they've jumped on their horses, if you like, and traveled after them and said, "What are you doing?"
Again, no horses here. This is a mountain area. Horses are useless in this area. And they're probably on foot, by the way.
Ah, so you reckon they ran after him?
They probably ran. You have to remember, these were people a lot more active than we are today. These were people who can probably run longer distances. I mean, for example, take the example of the marathons or the runs or whatever it is. It's very interesting that, for example, in marathons, we have a marathon here in Israel in Jerusalem once a year, and it's always someone from Africa who wins.
Mm-hmm.
And when you ask them, you know, how is it that you win? They say, because they walk everywhere. I had a friend who worked with me in the kitchens, and his father, who was from some village, had to walk every day to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. He had to walk about something like 40 kilometers a day to go to school. So he would leave home around 4 o'clock in the morning and start walking, and be at school by 8 o'clock in the morning. And he just walked, and he finished school around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then he walked back home. He arrived home at 7 o'clock in the evening, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the evening. You know, so maybe it was even shorter. Maybe he walked for 3 hours. I'm not too sure, but that's where it is. So here again, we're dealing with people who are a lot more active. They have the ability to move a lot faster than we do. You know, we think we have to go through the garbage. I've seen people take, you know, they live 100, 200 yards away from the garbage can or from the main thing. They take their car to throw the garbage, and it doesn't make sense. But that this is the reality we're in. So at that time, people were a lot healthier. Obesity was the privilege, so-called, quote-unquote, privilege of rich people.
Sure.
And really, the most people were thin and probably a lot more athletic than we are.
So this is serious stuff, because these 600 men who are probably on foot, they've also got their weapons of war, which is not,
remember,
you know,
They're traveling probably slower because they have children, they have women, they have animals, livestock with them, so they're probably traveling a lot slower. So say they travel in 1 hour, they cover a distance of, say, 5 kilometers, he can probably cover that distance in 20 minutes.
Sure, okay, so he's chased after them. He comes up and they say, "What ails you that you have gathered such a company?" So he said to them, "You've taken away my gods."
Like, what do you mean, what ails me?
You've stolen my gods.
What is that supposed to mean?
What do you mean, what ails me? You know very well that you nicked my gods. Give me back my gods. I want my gods.
Exactly. I mean, the whole conversation is kind of funny. It's like, who are you? What are you chasing us for? And it reminds me of types of fights that I've seen. It reminds me of types of fights I've seen in between. You have to remember, the mentality here is a bit different. The mentality here is very violent. We have to remember something. The Bible is a relatively violent book. So in this area, for example, just as an example with Arabs, I've seen it with Arabs a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a cultural thing, but I've seen a couple of times where the Arab does something completely wrong. And he walks up to me and he's saying, "What do you think you're doing?" He says, "I didn't do anything. What do you want from me?" Well, for example, mm-hmm. I saw an Arab kid nick someone's bike and he runs off with it. And the child chases him down together with his parents. And the child goes, "It's my bike. What are you talking about? What do you want from me? This is my bicycle." And they're witnesses and they stole it.
Right.
My bicycle. Complete denial. So this is probably kind of like the same thing as, like, you know, the turnaround says, "What do you want from us? You know, we didn't do anything wrong."
Yeah.
And at one point they kind of admit to it. They kind of admit to what they did, and they turn around to say, "Listen, don't mess with us. We're pretty harsh people. We're kind of violent. You don't want this to end. You don't want a bloody end here." So
they threaten his whole household.
They threaten everyone. They basically say to him, "If you don't back down, we'll basically kill you."
Yeah, it's exactly what happens. But honestly, I find verse 24 hilarious, because he said, you know, they say, you know, why are you cranky? Why are you chasing after us? He said, "Because you've taken away my gods, which I have made." He actually says this. "You've taken my gods, which I made. You've taken my I made those." And the priest.
You're stealing my income.
You're stealing my income, but I made those.
You're stealing my Levite. You're stealing my Kohen.
Oh dear!
And so, I mean, seriously. I can basically walk around with my Bible, go to these mega churches, and go, "You've stolen our God."
You could do that, except that it's a God that they've made, the way that they present it. Anyway, let's not go there.
I think people understand what I mean here. And they say to him, and the children of Dan said to him, "Al tashma kolecha imanu, do not make your voice be heard amongst us."
Mm.
For people might hear this. People are talking and say, "Listen, we have." He said, basically saying, "We have no control of this crowd." He's probably talking with the important people in the group or something, the leaders, and they basically turn around and say, "Listen, we have no control over the people here. We have no control whatsoever. You might say something, they'll get upset, and they'll pounce you. They'll kill you. We have no control." They're basically using kind of a game like, "Yeah, we understand you, we hear you, but, you know, there are people here that, well, listen, you know, don't even try."
So Micah makes a quick calculation, and it says here in mine in verse 26, he saw that they were too strong for him, and so he turned and went back to his house. He thought, "Well, you know, my little gods that I made, they're gone. My priest is gone. I don't have anything. But I tell you what, if I don't leave now, I won't even escape with my life. So let's just call it quits." And that's it. That's it for Micah. Off he goes. He'll probably go and make more gods. I mean, his mum still has 900 pieces of silver. I guess they can start again.
Whip up another one.
Whip up another one. In any case, that's him. He's just tail between his legs and off home to make a new religion. So verse 27, they took the things of Micah, the things that he had made, and the priest who had belonged to him, is what I've got in the English, belonged to him, and went to Laish, to the people, to a people quiet and secure. I kind of almost feel sorry for the people of Laish. They're these unassuming, peaceful town by the sounds of it. In any case, they struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. There was no deliverer because it was far from Sidon, and they had no ties with anyone. And it was in the valley that belongs to Bet Rehov. Is that right?
Bet Rehov. House of Rehov. The house of, well, Rehov in modern Hebrew means street. Rehov is probably from the root of Rechav, which means the wide house, the house of the wide place, maybe. You can translate it as this meaning.
Okay, the house of the wide place. And so they rebuilt the city and they dwelt there, and they called the name of the city Dan. Okay, now is that where Dan is today?
So I'm not too sure if it's exactly the same Dan. Again, geography is a bit tricky sometimes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there is a place called Tel Dan, which is understood to be the original site. And also what's very, very interesting about that site is they actually found an altar there, which they assume has to be part of... They found an altar in a whole temple complex, which they assume has to do with the altar of Jeroboam.
Really?
And the golden calves as well. And this is where we have this whole thing where I mentioned that. This is probably...
They didn't find the golden calves, did they?
No, they didn't. They didn't. No. The golden calves were probably taken away when the places were conquered.
Sure. Yeah.
But they were there for quite a while. And this is why I mentioned earlier that this might have been the origins of the priesthood, at least in part of the priesthood of Jeroboam. And this is some insight into what originally happened, because it says that Jeroboam took priests from the edges or the from basically took priests from the people, which were not from the Levites,
mm-hmm.
And this is probably some kind of insight who were some of these people. Criticism about this temple which existed in Dan and existed for quite a while because we actually have two very important verses here afterwards which give us some information about a couple of things. But this is probably some kind of open criticism about this temple which was probably running for quite a while and was probably running... it's questionable, but it might have been running even when King Solomon's temple was standing.
Sure.
But it's not 100% clear. But what we do discover here is that there's already an establishment of a temple in Dan. So when Jeroboam chose these places, these were already places which, in the mind of a lot of people, was already sanctified. Mm-hmm. So, and Jerusalem was a new place. So, for example, he positioned his temples in Dan and Beit El, and Beit El was already a place. It's called the House of El, so it was already considered to be a holy place. And we also have Beit El already mentioned in the stories of with Jacob that he slept in Beit El.
Yes.
And so the decision of putting the golden calves there wasn't random. So there was already established concept that this is a holy site, which sheds a lot of light on the culture of the time. And the understanding of what is holy and what is not holy, which raises a lot of... I mean, we can go into a very interesting discussion here about the concept of temples in general and what makes a place holy and what makes a place unholy and the positioning of holiness of a site and the shifting of that holiness from place to place is a very, very interesting discussion. I actually had an interesting discussion several years ago with this man who insisted that we have to go back to Shiloh. We don't have the Temple Mount, but we should continue sacrificing. We should continue everything. Let's build a temple in Shiloh. And I asked him why. He pointed out something interesting where he basically said, well, the Torah never specifies where to build a temple. It only says a place that God will choose. And it's actually a pure future in the text there.
Mm-hmm.
The one of the things that he pointed out to me, and I brought this up, I don't know if I brought it up with you a while back when we were talking about, one of the points that he was trying to bring up, and I think it's kind of extreme and maybe a bit over the top, but one of the things that he was trying to claim was that really the place that God will choose is a place that can change. And I gave him a very funny look, and I don't like that opinion, but there's something valid here, and I'm probably going to get angry emails after this one, but there's an interesting thing where the shift from a union of 12 tribes into a kingdom with one established place is optional. Deuteronomy basically says, if you want to have a king, this is how you have a king. But we don't see a king for a very, very long while. Now, there's criticism here in the book of Judges that there's no king, therefore each person does whatever he wants. So there's this issue of striving for king, but then we have Samuel saying, well, if you have a king, it's going to ruin everything.
Mm.
So there's this you can see this internal struggle regarding, this whole issue of being established. Do we have to be an organized, quote-unquote, religion, or are we just people in covenant with the God of Israel? And we have some kind of a centralized religious system. We have the tabernacle and everything. But does it really have to be like that? Do we have to have a centralization or not? And you can see this struggle, this interior struggle that the book of Judges and the book of Samuel have it. And we're talking about the book of Samuel now because we're almost there. Mm. But you can see this internal struggle of like, what really has to exist? Do we really have to have an organized system or not? Or is it, we have Levites, we have priests, we have tribal leaders, we might have some kind of organized king, but we don't really have to have a center of everything because it's really, there's a center, and the center is necessary for specific things, but not later on. There's a lot of these questions that were probably hovering in people's heads at the time when these stories were going on, and we're seeing this inside the text, and it's just fascinating. I'm actually reading a very, very interesting book. It's trying to reconstruct the mindset of an Israelite at the time, and the writer actually says, there's a lot of questions that have to be asked here. These strategic things, that it's obvious that people are struggling with at the time, and... It's just completely loony and complex. So
right.
We can never.
So what you're saying is that it wasn't as straightforward back then. Like trying to get into the to the mind of the Israelite back then, it wasn't entirely as straightforward, and that may be reflected in the way that the possibility, I think, is suggesting that this particular so-called Levite may have been the Aaron of the quote-unquote Aaron, the high priest, if you like, the first high priest of this Danite temple movement, but that was later or given credibility to by Jeroboam. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's kind of what I'm saying. How can he have such a legitimacy of a priesthood when we understand that he actually did have the Torah? How can he legitimize such a thing? And I think that part of it had to do with the confusion. There was a lot of confusion, and they also abandoned Torah to a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
And but there is an article, very interesting article I found, where they actually said that it seems that to a certain level, when when they were sacrificing in Dan, they were actually practicing based on the laws of Leviticus, because all the bones discovered there were kosher animals.
Mm-hmm.
But we're looking at a time where every person who wanted to be a priest, any person who wanted to have his whatever, I don't know, he wanted to be a priest, he wanted to be a spiritual leader, he could be, because people were abandoning the law of Torah, which basically said, no, there's a temple, which happens to be the tabernacle, and in time it turned into the temple of King Solomon, and we have to admit to this, we do see criticism about the establishment of a center. Jeremiah turns to the people and says to him, the house of the Lord, the house of the Lord, the house of the Lord, they say.
Mm-hmm.
And God runs and says, but this is not the point I wanted. This was not the point.
Mm-hmm.
The point to do righteousness, to do goodness with one another. I have my laws, but my point was something else. And you're confusing what I wanted with what you're establishing, with what you want to make money off of, where mm-hmm. you're going to have civilized power. For hundreds of years, I was in a tent and in a tabernacle. So what God says to King David, I was in a tent and a tabernacle and never asked anyone to build a temple for me, because that wasn't my point. And here we see the beginning of the corruption of this whole centralized religion, organized religion, whatever it is, where God basically said, listen, I gave you a Torah. Yes, there are religious leaders and I chose them. I handpicked that specific group. And this is the genealogy, and they're in charge of it, and you have to take care of these specific people so they'll be able to study Torah and be able to teach the people. And they're dependent on a lot of things when it comes to the nation. I gave you your land. There's a tabernacle. You have to come there 3 times a year. That's all I'm asking from you, 3 times a year to celebrate certain things, because we're trying to renew this covenant in between us. And you're going and building temples. You're going and doing the exact opposite of what I wanted. I wanted you because your father loved me. I want to give you a piece of land. I want to be in covenant with you. I want to love you as my people. Mm-hmm. Here are my statutes. Here are my commandments. I'm not even asking you to show up the temple every 5 minutes to worship me. All I'm asking from you is, if you look at the laws, most of them is righteousness in between people. Yes, there's a lot of laws. You take the book of Leviticus, most of it has to do with cleanliness and the temple and everything, but that's not something you're going to be dealing with in everyday life. That I've given to the priests to deal with, that I've given to the Levites to deal with. But when it comes to you, don't steal, don't murder, don't do this, don't do that. Help each other. If you see your friend with his load turned over, go and help him. You look at it, and a lot of it is basically a social, kind of like a social justice.
Sure,
you know, the temple. Yeah. In the hands of one group, that's their job, because that's what I want them to do for me, and this is the service to you, and they represent you as a nation. But mm-hmm. you live in your amongst yourselves, you live in your place, and there's this tabernacle. But I really want you just to believe in me and do what I told you to do, and take care of the poor and the widows. And you know, 3 times a year, go to the temple. Go 3 times a year, go to this tabernacle, this tent. It's not even a temple; it's just a tent. You know, perfectly fine with that. We actually see we see in the book of Haggai. He tells him, go up to the mountain, bring wood, build this temple. I'll be glad with it, even if it's a wooden temple. I don't need these huge, huge temples, you know. Like my grandfather, may he rest in peace, my grandfather, Alav Shalom, used to say that people are building what he calls golden mitzvahs, these huge golden pillars in the world. They build these huge synagogues, these things with like, tens of hundreds of feet in the air and everything. My grandfather used to go like, and what is exactly the point? I mean, if this huge structure.
Sure.
And I remember him saying that it was hilarious. It was just literally hilarious. But I think my grandfather had a very, very good point. My grandfather was basically saying,
me?
You know, I don't think that's the point of what the Torah is trying to teach us.
I think that's valid. And well, I mean, and among the things that you're, of course, don't, as you say, you know, don't murder, you know, do this, be nice, don't steal, you know, and obviously don't make a graven image and a carved image and idolatry and so on and so forth. But in any case, the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, Yehonatan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests. So there we are. We've got a family priesthood.
We actually have a problem here with this text. And this is a famous problem. The word Menasheh, the is actually hanging in the air. And some
what
people
is that about? Because I do have an asterisk there, and when I go down, it says, now speaking of the Septuagint, it says the Septuagint and the Vulgate reads Moses.
Exactly. There were two. There's a speculation here that this was actually the grandson of Moses. So this specific person actually was a Levite, but we don't know. There were probably two contradicting traditions about this. Either two contradicting traditions. It's one opinion that he was some man from the house of Menasheh. His grandfather was Menasheh, and some people. Grandfather was actually Moshe, and Moses actually had a son called Gershom. So there's that opinion. There's another opinion that says, no, it actually was Moses, but to our respect to Moses, look, his grandson became so corrupt, but our respect to him, with the word Menashe, we change his name just out of respect to Moses. And this is a very interesting thing. It's very rare that we have such a thing inside the text. There's a few places where there's a different consonant or something like that, but here it's very unusual. It's, I think, maybe even the only case where we have in the text a letter that's been pushed up, hovering in between the lines as a hint that something is wrong here.
Wow. That's mysterious. That's really quite mysterious, though, isn't it?
And it says his name was Yehonatan, the son of Yehoshom. So his name is Yehogave, which is a, you know, his name was, his name uses the name of God. He and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the land was exiled. And that's probably the hint. That is probably the hint of when the northern tribes were exiled.
Sure.
So this
is fascinating.
Here, the editing of the section here might have been later on. Again, the issue of editing the Bible, who wrote what stage, is very problematic. We don't know much. But this might have been a section which was originally part of the book of Joshua, or part of the beginning of the book of Judges, and was moved here by the scribes of King Hezekiah. So this section might have been added on later on by the scribes of King Hezekiah, because at that point the northern tribe was already exiled, and there's a lot of things we can pull out of this text. So this might be it. And then
I was just going to say, yeah, well, if it is Moses and it's edited to Manasseh, then it does add an even more greater validity to, if you like, or a greater credibility to their idolatry, right? So their temple system.
Exactly, and this card also can be part of the issue of how they identified him. They identified his voice because he's the grandson of Moses.
Sure.
Everyone knows this. But on the other hand, Micha didn't know who he was. So that raises a lot of questions. So it could be that the people of Dan made up a story that he was a Levite, and this section here is the made up story. But the other people knew the story was questionable. So the people of Dan were saying, "Oh, these are descendants of that of Moses," and other people said, "Descendants of Moses."
Hang on. So So verse 30, Yehonatan the son of Gershom. Are they suggesting? And I've only just picked this up. Is Judges 18 suggesting that the so-called Levite that we've been reading about all this time from chapter 17 through to the end of chapter 18, where we are now, is Yehonatan, son of Gershom?
So he probably, we can assume that his name was Yehonatan, son of Gershom, but
identifying. So it says, okay, because when I read this before, Yoel, when I read this before, I read this as something that had developed after this particular Levite. In my mind, you know, as things developed and they set up, they rebuilt, because it says, you know, they rebuilt the town, they did this, they did that, and as it says, thus and so, and then at some stage, Yehonatan, the son of Gershom, happened upon the Danites, and he became their priest. Is that also a possibility?
I highly doubt that. I
wow.
I don't really see them in
So you think this is identifying the Levite as Yehonatan?
Exactly. Identifying the Levite as Yehonatan, son of Gershom. And there might have been two separate traditions, one claiming he was a descendant of Moses. That might have been. Again, this is not 100%. Mm-hmm. That might have been a storyline that the Danites were using, saying, oh, he's a legitimate Cohen because he's a descendant of Moses. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the people went, probably not. His grandfather was probably called Menashe. He probably wasn't a real Levite. And there's a struggle here. This is an introduction to a lot of details. There's a mess. We have to admit, there's a mess here. There's nothing else I can say. It's a mess.
Wow, that is mysterious, though. That is rather curious. Be interested in listeners' comments on verse 30. And in any case, the final verse, it says, so they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. So it reiterates, the house of God, it ain't there, it's in Shiloh.
So it's telling us the house of God is in Shiloh, but there's a few things. It says here that he was a priest of the tribe of Dan until the land was exiled, and the statue of Micha, which he made all the days that the house of God was in Shiloh. Now the house of God was destroyed at one point. The house of God in Shiloh was destroyed at one point, at the times when Samuel was relatively young, and that's the first stories we have in the book of Samuel.
Mm.
So it could be that that specific statue was destroyed or exiled or got rid of at one point, maybe because of some religious understanding. Oh, we have to get rid of these pagan things, but the temple itself, the religious site stayed as a religious site. The temple actually existed. They just cleared out all the statues, they cleared out all the garbage, but left it as a temple because it mentions two separate things. They were priests until the land was exiled, and the only time we know the land was exiled was when the northern tribes were exiled. And then we have the statue itself was got rid of at one point, maybe because of some kind of religious upheaval or religious change. The Danites realized, oh, this is wrong, we have to get rid of it. Mm. But the place established as a temple.
Fascinating. There it is. Intriguing couple of verses by which our chapter ends, and that brings us to chapter 19. We're going to be doing that next week. Thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo Halevi, is your full name. His Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel, and there is a link on the sidebar on the right-hand side. You click on that, it'll take you to his Facebook page. Get involved and like the page. And if you would like Hebrew lessons, as I mentioned before, from the Levite and Land, you can inquire by emailing at hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. Thank you, Yoel. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, you can also show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. Very much appreciate those. And next week, Yoel, oh my goodness, Judges chapter 19, the Levite and his concubine.
Yeah, it's very interesting that some of the main characters, some of the most corrupt characters here are Levites.
Yeah, and this one is this is one of the messier chapters of the entire Tanakh, at least in my mind.
Yes, I think one of the worst stories.
It's kind of gruesome. I think next week's probably going to be an M-rated program. And
yes, I think next week, if for the next story, either please PG-13 or something whatever. And by the way, I also want to thank my my 3-year-old son who was behaving very well. You probably heard him in the background a bit, and he was helping us do the program anyhow.
Thank you,
Halevi III, for being such a cute little boy, not disturbing your father from doing the recording. This important recording, and I think we will be thankful that we anyhow can continue doing the recordings though I'm at home with the children.
Thank you, Halevi III. You've added an element of cuteness to the program that hasn't been there before. We hope you join us again, maybe not next week. But that's next week, Judges chapter 19. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, Kotu.